Here's a quote from one of the mothers of Churchill, Manitoba. I like to go out for walks, but it's a little awkward to push the baby stroller and carry a shotgun at the same time. Churchill, Manitoba is known as the polar bear capital of the world, and our guest this morning went there to try to see for himself what climate change really looked like up close and get the story behind the poster animals for global warming. Good morning, I'm Veronica Rickert, and I'm with you today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And our guest this morning is Zach Unger. He's a writer as well as a firefighter and paramedic with the Oakland Fire Department. He's written for Slate, The Economist, and Men's Journal. His latest book is called Never Look a Polar Bear in the Eye. And also joining us a bit later is Stephen Anstrup. He was the lead polar bear project leader with the U.S. Geological Survey and one of the top polar bear experts in the world. And we're always up to hear what's on your mind. Have you witnessed the effects of climate change up close for yourself? And do you think the environmental movement has put polar bears out front a little too often? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And our email is talk@wpr.org. And you can also check out what's going on our Facebook page, The Veronica Rickert Show. And Zach Unger, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Well, you know, most people go south for the winter, but it sounds like you went north. You took your wife and three kids, and you went from California to Churchill, Manitoba, otherwise known as the polar bear capital of the world. Tell us why you made that move.
Well, you know, I have a background in environmental science, and I was living my very comfortable life down here in California and doing little things to sort of save the earth. You know, I recycle, I turn off my computer, I have the good conscience to feel guilty about driving my minivan. But I felt like I hadn't been seeing the effects of global warming. I knew it was going on. It was something I very much believed in, but I needed to kind of reconvince myself and prove to myself that something really was going on. And it seemed that the easiest way to, or the best way to see the catastrophe would be to go check out the polar bears, because polar bears are the sentinel species in the entire climate change debate.
Right. And this was in what, around 2008?
Right.
And this was when the polar bear really was being put out there as, you know, sort of the spokes animal for climate change. And they are there, these amazing, charismatic animals. They're the megafauna of, you know, that part of the world. Going in and knowing all of that, how would you say you felt about the polar bear as it was becoming iconic?
Well, my plan at the beginning of this was very simple. I was going to write this mournful elegy and obituary for the polar bears. I was going to become a hero of the environmental movement. People were going to celebrate me as the second coming of John Muir, and my environmental compatriots were going to bear me off on their shoulders, because my idea was that I will write the definitive story of the death of the bear.
And that's not what happened.
You know, it's not what happened. As I got up there, the more and more I studied and the more people I talked to and the more scientists I talked to, I realized that having put forward the polar bear as the sentinel species of climate change might not have been the best idea. And in fact, bear populations in a lot of places are healthier than I expected, which was great news for the bear, terrible news for my quest to become an environmental hero, but a very interesting case study in how the media and the environmental community fixates on one issue and goes with it.
Well, and there was a lot of science in the beginning, and since then, since 2008, saying that the polar bears, you know, they are in fact in trouble. And you start your book with some of this coverage that was carried by a lot of media about polar bears turning to cannibalism because the sea ice was not lasting as long and they were forced to kill each other to eat. And this captured a lot of people's attention and the imagination, and there were images of blood on the snow. And it sort of launched how people, a lot of compassion and worry and fear about polar bears. But you think at the end of the day that some of that is misguided.
Well, you know, there had been a story about polar bears cannibalizing each other, and it had happened. Scientists had observed it happening three or four times in a single season, and this was very unusual. And so they published about it, and it got picked up by all of the news wires and the TV stations, because this is an incredible thing. I mean, we know that most animals don't eat their own kind, and so to say that polar bears were starving badly enough to eat each other was huge news, and it certainly had happened in a few instances. But what I think happened was that these small, isolated incidents got taken to be the whole, and people say, oh my God, they must just be eating each other night and day, 24 hours every week. But that's not what was happening, and an isolated incident got blown up to greater proportions.
Now, this really becomes the crux of your book, not just the cannibalism, but the idea that polar bears are endangered, and beyond that, possibly going extinct by 2050. But the question you're asking is, are they really in trouble, or are they adapting, and in fact, in some cases, thriving? And there was an elite group of polar bear researchers that you approached, and they pretty much wouldn't let you tag along. You wanted to tag along. You couldn't get in that circle. But you did find a scientist who usually studies geese who would let you tag along. Tell me about him.
Well, like you said, it's hard to get these polar bear experts. I call them the heavy hitters. It's sort of a group of less than a dozen of them they're so in demand. They're always testifying in front of Congress. They're on the front page of the New York Times. Trying to get one of them to return your call is like trying to get Mick Jagger to play your Labor Day picnic. So I was having trouble breaking through with them, and I found one guy by the name of Dr. Robert Rockwell. He prefers to go by the name Rocky. And he and his grad student, Linda Gormazano, Rocky had been out in the bush near Churchill for 40 summers, and he knew polar bears as well as anybody. Even though he was initially a goose scientist, he was a population biologist, and he made the point that one species is like another species when it comes to the population biology and the math. And so in the course of studying snow geese, he had learned a lot about polar bears, and what he was finding was that the numbers, the statistics, and also the facts on the ground that he was hearing from these heavy hitters just weren't adding up. So one thing that's important to know about polar bears is that they eat seals. And the way that they eat seals is that they go out on the ice. They can't hunt from seals from the coast. They have to actually go out on the frozen sea ice and hunt seals from out there. So if the sea ice is not there, then there's no platform from which the bears can hunt, and then they can't eat. So what Rocky was finding, actually, however, was that polar bears have a much wider, varied diet than people thought. They can eat caribou, they can eat kelp, they can eat geese. And in fact, there's been a massive explosion of snow geese up in the Canadian Arctic. And Rocky was suggesting, not saying that geese could be a complete replacement for seals, but that eating snow goose eggs and snow goose nests might be a way for polar bears to somewhat bridge the gap in loss of sea ice.
Now, Dr. Rockwell, the scientist that you worked with when you were up there, what university was he affiliated with?
He's affiliated with the American Museum of Natural History in New York and the City University of New York.
And how are his theories, his science, what he was finding there, treated in the scientific community?
He and Linda both found that they had a hard time getting their theories heard with the heavy hitters. Like I said, it's a very small group. They tend to publish in a sort of small network of journals that they tend to peer review each other a lot. And so it became a very sort of insider boys club of publishing. And Rocky and Linda found it very difficult to get their message out. And, I should emphasize that it's not just Rocky and Linda. There's this idea that they're is no debate about polar bear numbers. And in fact, there are many reputable scientists, well-credentialed, who have differing opinions about the health of the polar bears, but in popular conventional wisdom, it hasn't been seen as a live debate.
Well, this polar bear population that you were closest to when you were in Churchill is the Hudson Bay population, right?
Right.
How are they doing? And how are they doing now? So it's been, about 5 years since you wrote your book. What have you seen?
The Hudson Bay population, that's the one that if you've ever seen a picture of a polar bear, it's from that Hudson Bay population. And if a friend of yours has ever gone on a polar bear trip, that's where they've gone. But here's the thing with the Hudson Bay polar bear. In between 1984 and 2004, the population fell from about 1,200 to about 900. It's a pretty precipitous drop. It was a drop of about 22%. And at the time, they suggested that population would further drop to about 675 by 2011. So that's a major drop. Now, they just finished a study in the last year, and that population is at 1,013. So it's actually increased since the 2004 study, not decreased precipitously, and which is actually great news. And it's interesting to me the resistance there's been from the heavy hitters and from some in the environmental community to trumpet this news as the sort of success story that it is.
And what about other populations of polar bears? Maybe there's something about Churchill. I mean, I don't know, you mentioned some people feeding the polar bears. Now, that can't be responsible for a population explosion, but maybe there's some geographical feature that is helping those polar bears to adapt. What about polar bears elsewhere in the world?
Well, the thing to remember is that polar bears are not a single monolithic population. There are 19 polar bear subpopulations in the world, and about a third of them are decreasing. About a third of them are stable or increasing, and the remaining third just don't have enough data to say. And so if you just focus on one particular population, if you just cherry-pick something, you can make the case that polar bears are doing fantastic or that polar bears are doing terribly. But if you look at polar bears on the aggregate currently, how they are today across all 19 populations, they appear to be stable. There's one population that's gone from 900 to 2,100, and then there are other populations that are on a dramatic decrease. So to just say that there is one trend is misleading.
So are you trying to say that there should at least be a conversation about this, about how accurate this narrative is about polar bears being in decline and facing extinction? Or are you saying that this is false and misleading and that the environmental movement needs to actually back off using polar bears as, you know, these spokes animals for climate change?
Well, the way one scientist put it to me, she said that polar bears seem to be doing well now, but there are grave worries about the future. And I think that's the way to put it. What I'm worried about is that when you start making these incredibly definitive pronouncements, and there are some scientists who are fond of saying that polar bears will be extinct by 2050 or polar bears will be extinct by this date certain, when you start making these grand concrete pronouncements, what happens if 2050 rolls around, polar bears are not extinct, but some other animal is in trouble? You will have damaged the credibility of scientists. And I think it's very important that scientists not blur that line from science to advocacy, because then they lose their ability to remain neutral in the public debate and be trusted by all sides.
Isn't that what scientists do, though, in a sense? I mean, they do the best science that they can, and drawing from that, you know, they extrapolate what they can about the future and the impact on these populations. They could be wrong, but isn't that just part and parcel of how scientists work?
Sure, but the problem with the polar bear study is that, you know, there in science there are always assumptions you have to make. You always have to make choices. And a lot of times what polar bear scientists do is if there is A or B, they will always choose whichever assumption makes things look worse for the polar bear. Or they will only talk about populations that are doing poorly and not talk about the populations that are doing well. And I completely understand it. I mean, everyone wants what's best for the polar bear, and these scientists have devoted their lives to looking at polar bears. And so I understand that they are worried. But you can't let the numbers, you can't let the outcome lead your numbers. And I'm not saying that these guys are faking their data or anything like that, just that they are so invested in the narrative that polar bears are on the decline, that the kind of data they present tends to back that up.
So your book is part scientific exploration, like we're talking about now, and you're challenging some of the assumptions that we take for granted about where polar bears are headed. It's also part a memoir. There's lots of moments in your kids and in Churchill, Manitoba, and what that's like, seeing, you know, a culture that's used to polar bears ambling down the street and people walking around with shotguns at certain seasons. So it's both things, but it's become a bit of a controversy, and you have had some attacks leveled at you. You've been called a climate change denier. What do you make about that in terms of, you know, how you wanted your book to be received?
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, polar bears are one of the few animals that have become full-fledged hostages of the culture wars. I mean, if you tell me what you think about the health of polar bears, I can probably guess what you think about tax rates, reproductive rights, and, you know, border security. It's just, it's taken on this outsized importance, and it's become so incredibly linked with climate change that you can't separate polar bears from climate change. Now, I do not want anyone to think that I'm a climate change denier. Climate change is happening. It's real. 99% of scientists agree that climate change is happening. Now, the effects of climate change on polar bears are more of a debate, and I think it's important to separate those two things. But it's been interesting for me. I mean, I live in the Bay Area in Oakland and Berkeley, and, you know, this is the greenest community around. And so when I tell people that I don't think that polar bears are doing as bad as they might have thought before, you know, I'm treated like an environmental criminal. The torches and pitchforks come out. And, you know, I would have thought that this would have been a very heartening development, that I could tell people, like, hey, you know, polar bears are doing better than you thought. But actually, it's a bit of apostasy.
Hmm. Is there anything you'd like to correct now, looking back? I mean, the tone of your book, sometimes you kind of lightly make fun of the environmental movement. You call them crunchy granola tree huggers. And, you know, you're saying, oh, I'm here in the Bay Area and the weather is fine, but I don't see any evidence of climate change. You can see why sometimes people might get their backs up a little about it. Would you do anything differently?
Well, I think it's true that I don't see any evidence of climate change when I look out my window, but I absolutely see evidence of climate change when I read the studies of people who are studying climate change. I mean, climate change is so incremental and small that from day to day, you know, I can't see it when I walk around the streets of Berkeley. However, I don't want to give the impression at all that I don't think climate change is happening. The science is incontrovertible.
Zach Unger is one of our guests this morning. He is a writer as well as a firefighter and paramedic with the Oakland Fire Department. He's written for Slate, The Economist, and Men's Journal. And his latest book that we're talking about this hour is called Never Look a Polar Bear in the Eye, and trying to get a handle on what actually is going on with the polar bear population. Where is it and where is it going? And next, we're going to be joined by Stephen Amstrup, who was the Polar Bear Project leader with the U.S. Geological Survey and one of the top polar bear experts in the world. And we're curious about what you think. Do you think that polar bears have been overused by the environmental movement? And is it time to back off that and take a look at maybe some of the arguments that Zach has been suggesting this past 20 minutes or so? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And our email is talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 1 o'clock, stay tuned for Talk of the Nation Science Friday. Do the comments made on a website change your view on the news? Join Ira Flatow for a look at some of the pitfalls of science journalism in our online world on Talk of the Nation Science Friday. Veronica Rickert with you this hour on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking polar bears this hour and taking a look at a new book that says, you know, the polar bear populations actually aren't doing so bad right now. The projections for their thriving maybe are not as sanguine, but right now they're doing okay, and maybe we need to dial back the way the environmental movement is using polar bears. But we're going to be talking now with Stephen Amstrup, who's one of the top polar bear experts in the world. He was the Polar Bear Project leader with the U.S. Geological Survey at the Alaska Science Center in Anchorage, Alaska. He's also an adjunct professor at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks, and he's been conducting research on all aspects of polar bear ecology in the Beaufort Sea since 1980, and he's a scientist affiliated with Polar Bears International. Stephen Amstrup, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, Stephen, you're one of the people that Zach Unger, our guest this hour, calls the heavy hitters in his book. We're one of the leading polar bear scientists. And in this book, he takes you to task for blurring the line a little bit between science and advocacy. What would you say to that?
Well, I would say that's a gross mischaracterization. If you look at the work that we did at the USGS, it was strictly science. It was science that we did in hopes of informing policymakers and managers. But everything was run through peer review processes, published in scientific journals, and there is no advocacy there. There is information that people who would like to advocate for the welfare of polar bears hopefully can use. But we had strict policies at the USGS about the extent to which we could get into advocacy roles, and we were strictly forbidden from doing so. I think it's important to correct a couple of other things that Zach has said. If you look at the projections that we made regarding the future of polar bears, Nobody ever suggested that we would see exactly by 2050 or exactly by the end of the century that all polar bears would disappear. We expressed it scientifically as the most probable outcome is that by the middle of this century, we would see this number of populations likely disappear. And by the end of the century, the most likely outcome was that all of them could disappear if we remain on our current greenhouse gas path. And the foundation for that is that polar bears depend entirely on the sea ice for catching their prey. And the sea ice melts as the temperatures warm. Planetary physics require that the world will continue to warm as long as greenhouse gas concentrations rise. So whether it's 2050 or 2100 or sometime beyond that, ultimately, if we don't do something about greenhouse gas emissions, all of the sea ice will be gone and all of the polar bear habitat will be gone. Now, is it possible that some small groups of polar bears might find a way to persist for a while in some areas? Sure. You know, but what we're interested in as scientists is maintaining healthy, viable populations. And some small cluster of bears that figures out a way to make a living on land for a while isn't exactly the outcome that we're interested in.
Tell us about the polar bear populations as you understand them. Zach said, I think, is a third of the populations are up, a third are down, and the rest are, we don't have enough data to know. Do you agree with that?
Not exactly. There's 19 recognized subpopulations of polar bears, and of those, eight are currently thought to be declining. There's a number that we don't know enough about to say what the status is, but right now there's only one that's actually thought to be increasing. What's interesting is to contrast those most recent conclusions of the polar bear specialists of the world with what that same group concluded in 2005, and at that time, only five populations were thought to be in decline. And back in 2001, the same group concluded that only one population was thought to be in decline. Now, there's a lot we don't know about polar bears, and unfortunately, our detailed knowledge is limited to a relatively few of the subpopulations. But if you add up what the best science tells us and what our best biological instincts tell us, the number of populations that's moving towards decline has been increasing through the decade.
And so you're standing by that 2050 number, that this is the most likely scenario should climate change keep eroding the sea ice and shortening the season for polar bear hunting. 2050 is still that number.
Yeah, absolutely. The middle of the century, based on all of the projections we have, the sea ice in the areas that are critical to the populations that we described in our paper that amount to about two-thirds of the world's current population are likely to disappear. And that includes polar bears in Alaska, polar bears in Hudson Bay, polar bears in much of the rest of the polar basin, where sea ice is formed in the wintertime but is continually being moved away from the coast and out into the center of the basin. These areas are highly vulnerable. We're seeing dramatic changes in the habitat already, and by the middle of the century, if we don't do anything about our greenhouse gas emissions path, we don't think there's going to be enough sea ice there to maintain populations anything like those that we currently have.
So one of the things that Zach says is that polar bears have been used, and you know, maybe used too much by the environmental movement, that they've become sort of the poster children of climate change, and that if, for an example, this 2050 date isn't right, that polar bears are actually doing okay, that some of the populations are up, that it's only going to hurt the environmental movement, and it's going to take away credibility. And I know that you're a scientist, and this sort of iconography within a movement is not really your specialty, but what do you think about that? Or is the environmental movement pushing polar bears too much?
Well, no, I don't think so, because I think people have a difficult time appreciating climate change. Zach said he can't see climate change when he looks out of his window in San Francisco. Most people can't appreciate it. Polar bears are right on the edge, however, because they depend on a habitat that literally melts as temperatures rise. So they will be among the very first species that are likely to wink out as a result of increasing temperatures. And ultimately, those rising temperatures will affect all life on Earth. But in the moment, we can see that the forecast for polar bears is not good. So I think that it's entirely appropriate to use polar bears as a messenger for what we're doing to the world. Now, has it been overstated, and have some people not been very clear in the statements that they've made? Absolutely. When we talk about that we might lose two-thirds of the world's polar bears by the middle of the century, that says nothing about all of the steps that might occur between now and then. We're talking about a situation of a long-term trend that's overridden by a lot of natural variation. And that natural variation, the natural variation that we see around us now in the weather and climate, will continue as the temperatures rise, but it's going to continue over a steadily rising baseline. So some populations may see some transient benefit from a warming climate. I mean, we have documented in the past, Ian Sterling, one of my foremost colleagues, and I have both written about how the Beaufort Sea population, for example, historically was sometimes limited by an environment that was too cold and too harsh. In situations like that, we might see some transitory benefit from a warming environment. But as the world continues to warm, those animals will move from a position of benefiting from climate change to suffering from it. And I think that's a really important point, is people confuse the natural interannual variation with the long-term trend.
Okay. Well, Zach has been listening along, and I want to give him just a chance to respond. And we also have a slew full of callers who are waiting to talk to you both. So, Stephen, if you're able to stay on, that would be fantastic. And let's get Zach's response, and then we'll dig into some of our calls. Zach, is there anything you want to respond to as you've been listening?
I think that Dr. Anstrup has done very good work, and I don't dispute a lot of what he has to say. But I do think that there is a risk, and that at times these top polar bear scientists have played into the desire to get the story out in the media. I mean, as a journalist, you know that the headline, "Things are staying steady," is much less appealing than the headline, "Catastrophe approaches." And so these numbers, like the 2050 number, like the instances of polar bear cannibalism, they get into the media, and I don't think that the heavy hitters and Dr. Anstrup and others have done enough to sort of tamp down the media's desire to sensationalize these bits that come to stand in for the whole.
Well, I want to take a caller now and get to Scott, who's joining us in Green Bay. Hi, Scott.
Good morning.
Morning.
You know, I just want to interject. I was up in Alaska here several years ago. We were just up on the north slope south of Dead Horse. And I know we ran into polar bears. This is like October. They were coming in from the coast because obviously the sea ice wasn't formed yet. So we were, you know, out there hunting, and we were doing some camping. Everybody got a little nervous, and we started seeing polar bears. But I know some of the locals up there also, they said it's kind of unusual to see those bears that time of year coming in from the coast, you know, trying to find food. And I know the one that we did see one day, he was on a carcass of a caribou, and, you know, I doubt if those bears up there are going to be eating snow geese.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they looked like they were in trouble, as far as I could tell.
And let's get you both in on that. Steve, why don't you start?
Well, one of the things that we see in polar bears and in other species, for that matter, is as habitat declines, the animals begin to go other places to try and find food. And in the case of the Beaufort Sea in northern Alaska, it used to be that the sea ice was available in the nearshore environment over the continental shelf where the most productive waters are. It was available there throughout the summer. that's no longer the case. And so the bears are forced to decide whether to go way offshore into the distant deep water that is known not to be very productive, or to stay on land and hope that they can find something to eat. And sure, they can find some things to eat on land, but we have no evidence that anything that's on land is going to effectively replace the seals that they no longer have access to. And I think this is one of the things that, that people have really gone overboard about, is, oh, well, polar bears are bears. They can eat lots of things, and they'll come ashore, and they'll eat goose eggs, or they'll eat caribou or whatever. But the data that we have, and as a scientist, I always have to resort to the data. The place where we know the most about polar bears is Western Hudson Bay. And there, my colleagues have shown that when the bears are stuck on land in the summertime, they lose about a kilogram of body weight per day while they're waiting for the sea ice to freeze up. Now, polar bears and other bears don't diet on purpose. If there was a way that they could offset that weight, they would be doing so. And, you know, to think that, that they're waiting until some weight threshold and then suddenly they're going to start finding stuff to eat, that's kind of silly. The other empirical example that we have of how well bears, polar bears might be able to fare on land is indeed in northern Alaska. On land in Alaska, there are grizzly bears. And the grizzly bears of northern Alaska are the smallest of all of the brown bear group worldwide and the most sparsely distributed. That is, they occur at very low densities. That's because that terrestrial environment, the land environment, is very poor from the standpoint of a bear making a living. Now, does it make sense to think that a whole population of the largest bears in the world is going to be able to move on to land and find a way to make a living in a place that currently supports only very small numbers of very small bears?
And I want to get Zach in on this, because this is the area that, that Dr. Rockwell is looking at. Zach, what would Dr. Rockwell say, and what have you seen about that?
Well, you know, Dr. Rockwell, he wouldn't oversell it. I mean, I don't think he's trying to make the point that polar bears are going to be just fine because they can eat geese. But I think he is saying that over long term, these are very long term trends, you know, hundreds of years, there might be a way that polar bears could bridge some of the gap in the loss of sea ice to some degree, that some bears might get some subsistence from eating some other species besides seals. And again, I don't want to oversell this as polar bears are going to explode when they eat seals. But as Dr. Amstrup stated, there are certain populations where global warming has actually been a net positive, and we have areas where seal populations have increased and polar bears have exploded. And if we just focus on the populations where things are doing badly, then things will look badly. I think one fact that always surprises me that has not broken through is that there are more polar bears alive today than there were 40 years ago. The number of worldwide population is bigger than it was 40 years ago, and that is not something that I had any idea going in. And it's not something that I think the general public knows. And we can't just say that polar bears are on the verge of extinction without acknowledging the fact that there's been an increase.
Is that because of hunting regulations?
Yes. In the early 70s, there was a global hunting ban, except for all but indigenous peoples. And
so that's not really a factor in terms of climate change. It's kind of a non-factor.
No, it's not. But here's the thing. If we are theorizing that two-thirds of the world's polar bears are going to die, then that's going to take us down to about where we were 40 years ago when nobody was talking about the climate change as an issue. In the mid-60s, you had the polar bear scientists saying that polar bears were on the verge of extinction. By 1990, you had polar bear scientists saying no extinction was going on, that polar bears were doing well. And then by the early 2000s, you had polar bear scientists saying that the population was going to crater again. Now, this is a long-lived species that does not swing back and forth quite that quickly.
Well, we're talking this hour about polar bears with two of our guests. We've got Zach Unger on the line, who has written a new book called Never Look a Polar Bear in the Eye. He's a journalist who's written for Slate, The Economist, and Men's Journal, and he spent some time in Churchill, Manitoba, and he did research with a scientist called Dr. Rockwell, and Zach thinks maybe the environmental movement is overstating the dire situation that polar bears find themselves in, and that, in fact, some populations are actually doing all right. It might be time to dial down that rhetoric about polar bears. Also joining us, we have Stephen Anstrup, who was the Polar Bear Project leader with the U.S. Geological Survey. He is one of the top polar bear experts in the world, and he's helping us sift through the science this hour as well. Our number is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, and you can also email us at talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert back with you today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we talk polar bears this hour and try to sift through some of the science to get at how they're doing. Zach Unger is joining us this hour. He's got a new book out called Never Look a Polar Bear in the Eye. And we're also joined by Stephen Anstrup, who was the Polar Bear Project leader with the U.S. Geologic Survey. And he's one of the top polar bear experts in the world with us this hour as well. And we'll go back to the phone lines now and talk to Earl from Bedford. Hi, Earl.
Good morning. Great show. And I lived in Barrow, Alaska, and did the radio news there for over 20 years. And I haven't heard the Inupiat version of all this come up. The Inupiat people have been hunting polar bears for hundreds and hundreds of years, and they are concerned. All the elders I talk to are concerned about climate change. And also George Devokey, a bird scientist, has a database of 30 years just studying the black guillemots, a seabird out there. And just recently, he's saying the polar bears are sticking around. They can't get to the ice, so they're coming in and eating guillemot chicks. So there's a lot of evidence to concern, especially the Inupiat people.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you for bringing up that perspective, Earl. Appreciate your call. And we'll go first to Steve. Steve, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
You want to respond to that?
Well, I think that what Earl points out is just one of many symptoms of the changes that are occurring up there, and it's not just polar bears. I mean, people in many areas of the north are seeing their houses sink into the tundra because of a warming climate. I think it's important to clarify a few things that Zach made, a few statements that Zach made a moment ago. One is this issue that there's more polar bears now than there were 40 years ago. Actually, 40 years ago, we had no idea how many polar bears there were. And the statement that polar bears have doubled or tripled since the 1960s is something that climate change deniers have concocted by cherry-picking a few statements that some scientists made. There certainly wasn't a consensus on this. Very early on, before we knew much about what was happening. So it's important when people say that to recognize that that's simply not something that polar bear scientists believe. Now, I think it's likely that polar bears have recovered somewhat, as you pointed out, as a result of protection from hunting. But that's an entirely different issue from loss of habitat. And I also think it's important to clarify, you know, Zach said that the changes we're seeing are slow. And in fact, if we don't change our greenhouse gas path, by the middle of this century, polar bears will be experiencing temperatures that are warmer than anything that they've likely experienced any time in their evolutionary history, at least since they became dependent on the sea ice. And another point is that, you know, we often hear people say, well, polar bears have experienced warm cycles in the past. And that statement leads people to believe that what we're going through now is also a cycle, but in point of fact, it's not. What we're experiencing now is an upward linear trend that will not change unless we change greenhouse gas emissions. And so again, what we're really concerned about is not the number of polar bears that are out there now. What we're concerned about is the future, and a future that will have no sea ice to support polar bears if we don't do something about it. And, you know, frankly, in 50 years, we see the loss of polar bears that I have projected in some of my work, by then nobody's going to be caring about polar bears because they're going to be too busy dealing with refugee problems in North America, things that we haven't ever seen before. So, you know, it's important to keep everything in perspective. We are concerned about the long-term trend, And sure, there's a lot of variation that is going to happen between now and when we reach there, but all of the scientific evidence points to the direction of a long-term problem for polar bears and essentially everything else.
And real quick, because we have a lot of callers, but Zach, did you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is kind of the problem here, where when I start talking about polar bears, we start shading into me becoming a climate change denialist, and that's not the case at all. And I agree with Steve when he says that polar bear populations are stable now and that we have to look at how they're going to be in the future. But for no other species do we use do we do crystal science by crystal ball. We have to manage them now. And then as for the natives, you know, I spoke with the head of the Inuit organization in Canada, and they feel that they're seeing more polar bears than ever. That's something that I find when I talk to people who are around polar bears, is a lot of them feel that the polar bear populations are large or stable. And I don't think we can discount Inuit knowledge, and a lot of Inuit organizations who depend on polar bears in a way that nobody down south understands don't feel that polar bears are in crisis at the moment and that we need to manage them for the moment, not for a potential future.
All right. Well, thanks. And we'll go next to another caller who's been waiting. Rick joins us from Platteville. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Veronica. Great show.
Thank you. I appreciate
your attention to the topic. You know, I think one of the problems with using the polar bear as an icon or a symbol of climate change is that a lot of people will assume that it's the only species that's affected by climate change, or one of the few species that's affected. And, you know, right here in Wisconsin, we have several species I can think of. I wrote an article for Wisconsin Trails magazine last year that looked at some Wisconsin symbol species that are going to be, and already are, dramatically impacted by climate change. The sugar maple trees, cranberries, musk lounge. We have a lot of species that our experts here in the state are really worried about because of climate change. And when you look at the loss of sea ice, you know, what about the loss of lake ice here in Wisconsin? Experts at the SeaGrad Institute here in Madison have said that we've lost a week of ice cover on our lakes for every decade since the 1950s.
Great.
I would like your guest to respond to that.
Great. Thank you so much for calling, Rick. And we finally have a couple of open lines if you'd like to call at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And Stephen, is the polar bear overshadowing other aspects of climate change and other species that might be affected?
Well, I think there is a potential for that, of course. The charismatic megafauna, the large carnivores of the world, really capture a lot of people's attention. And to some extent, there is the potential for that to detract from a focus on other species. But what I like to think of is that the polar bear is a symbol for what's happening to the world as a whole, and not really overshadowing concerns about other species, but highlighting the fact that we have a problem. We're changing the world as we've known it. And ultimately, the effects of climate change are going to be felt by everything on Earth. And it just happens that polar bears are one of the first ones to be affected. And so, you know, I can see the value in using something that people can identify with. Polar bears clearly have captured the human imagination. I can see the value of using polar bears as a way to focus people's attention on this very broad problem that we have to change our sources of energy.
And what about what Zach said right before, oh, was it the break, I think, that we need to manage the population now and not use a crystal ball and, you know, guess about the future?
Well, scientists have historically always tried to project what the future trend is likely to be for species. And for terrestrial species, often it's been, well, what do we expect the future for this particular species to be if we continue to log this habitat or if we continue to cultivate this much more habitat and things like that. What we haven't ever had in the past is a chronic change that we can predict with absolute certainty if we don't change our ways. Now, there's a lot of noise in the projections as far as exactly when we're going to reach a certain temperature or exactly when it might be too warm to grow corn in Iowa or something like that. But what we do know ultimately is that those thresholds will be crossed if we don't change our ways. So, you know, I think that it's really critical that we think in the broad sense, think in the long term, and recognize that in the short run, there's going to be a lot of things that either we don't understand or that may even seem like they're contrary to the long-term trend. But that's part of the chaos of the climate system.
And Zach, what about you? What do you think about Rick's call about polar bears overshadowing some other species that might need our attention too?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the problem with focusing on one species is the problem of putting all of your eggs in one basket. I mean, we cannot predict exactly what's going to happen in the future, and I hope that polar bears do well. But when you focus on one species, if anything is wrong in your predictions, if anything changes climatologically, then you end up with maybe polar bears doing better than you thought, and science loses credibility. And I think it's very important that scientists not focus on one animal or on advocacy, because if that one animal doesn't prove to be as endangered as we had thought before, you're going to lose a generation of people who are not going to have that sort of trust in science anymore. And, you know, when Dr. Amstrup left USGS and went to, you know, had he left USGS and gone to Chevron or something, you know, we would say that this was an example of industry capture. But when you leave USGS and go to Polar Bears International, which is an advocacy group, you know, that same risk is there. And we need to focus on all of these different species so that if we happen to get data that doesn't match our public relations, then we're not in trouble, because global warming is happening, and we can't let just one species stand in for that.
I want to go back to the lines, and we'll take Mike next from Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Veronica. Thanks for taking my call. I'll try to be brief. What about the phenomenon of polar bears interbreeding with grizzly bears? I assume that a polar bear-grizzly bear hybrids would be more omnivorous than pure polar bears, so they may not become extinct but survive with a different look and diet. I'll take any response off the air. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Mike. And Stephen, that seems like a good one for you.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people have expressed hope that maybe the salvation of polar bears is in their ability to interbreed with grizzly bears. And genetic evidence suggests that there may have been episodes of interbreeding during the course of the evolutionary history of the polar bear. The point is that we as polar bear scientists aren't really concerned about whether or not some polar bear genes continue to persist in a future animal that lives on land like a grizzly bear. We actually would like to see the persistence of polar bears as we know them today. And, you know, we have that ability. Our work has shown that if we get our act together, we can preserve enough sea ice habitat to preserve viable populations of polar bears. But we need to get busy and do that. And sure, if we don't do that, there may be some time on Earth into the future when there will be some polar bear genes floating around in the bodies of animals that look like brown bears. But is that really the conservation goal that we're after? I don't think so.
And we're getting close to the end of the hour. We've got about 30 seconds for you both. Zach, what do you most want people to take away from the science and what you saw in Churchill?
I want people to understand that science and advocacy need to be separate. I want people to understand that there are more polar bears alive today and that it's okay to tout that as a success story. There are problems in the future, but the future is not today, and we need to look at what the science tells us today and react from that.
And Stephen, what about you? What do you want people to know and to take away about polar bears as we head into the coming years?
I think it's important that people who are interested actually take a look at the scientific papers and realize that there isn't any advocacy there. There's fuel to be used by advocates. And the reason that I left the USGS was because although there are lots of questions that we could still ask about polar bears, we already know the answer to the one, what we need to do to save them. And so I moved from being a research scientist to being an advocate for polar bears. to focus on outreach in order to get that message out to the public in hopes that the public will act in time.
All right. We're out of time. Thank you both so much for your time, Asar. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Zach Unger is the author of Never Look a Polar Bear in the Eye. And we're also joined by Stephen Anstrup, who is the Polar Bear Project Leader with the U.S. Geological Survey. And he's also an adjunct professor at the University of Alaska. Thanks to Marika Suval for producing. I'm Veronica Rickert.